Welcome to a very special episode of the Idea Factory podcast. I feel like it's one of those Brady Bunch episodes where they go on vacation to Hawaii. It's actually nothing like that. I did a really fun interview with Yifat Cohen. She does a variety of really cool interviews on Google+. I'm going to put the link into the show notes on Idea Factory. What makes this episode particularly good is it's probably the first time I've gotten into this much detail about the concepts in my book, Econovation. I'm slowly starting to come to terms with the possibility that not everyone has read it. I know that's shocking, but hopefully some of the ideas here tickle your imagination enough to buy the book, or even better, don't buy the book and just send me the check. But in either case, it's a fun chat. Here it is. Just before I go, I should remind you to go to ideafactory.com so you can see the show notes, subscribe to future episodes. You can also get them on iTunes. You also won't want to miss next week's episode. I'm going to have a guest, an author who wrote Social Media is Bullshit. And that is going to be a great conversation. The man is a fellow skeptic about some of the hysteria that goes on about social media and some of the crazy overinvestment. Although he tweeted me the other day and told me that he was working on a Twitter project. So I'm going to have to find out from him exactly what that means and why the guy who says social media is bullshit.
This is Yifat, your G-Plus go-to-gal. And today we are trying to position ourselves in front of trends so that we can be successful in the next year. What a better topic to start 2013. And we have with us the amazing Steve Factor from where?
Idea Factory. Now Idea Factory. And also Forbes, and also I'm on LinkedIn as an influencer, a bunch of different places, Harvard Business Review.
So you are an American Express guy, and now you're an author.
I am an author, yeah. My book came out at the end of 2011. It's called Econovation. And it's all about, you know, what the next decade will bring and where the opportunities will be for innovation. So, you know, seems like an appropriate title and topic for what you've described.
Yeah, so when I actually first read your articles, I found your Forbes article. And you were talking about how the future is going to be changing and we're moving towards producerism. Am I saying it right?
That's right, producerism.
So rather than being America, the capitalistic center of the world, we are going to start producing things again, right?
Well, it's still capitalism. Capitalism has two sides, right? It has the producer and the consumer. Actually, it has three. It has the facilitator. Most of the innovation that we've seen over the last, I would say, 10 years, certainly the stuff that's been happening online, has all been in the facilitator realm. So it's all been a replacement of middlemen, if you think about it. So, you know, all of these efficiencies we've seen with Amazon, with, you know, online procurement, with online sourcing, with self-servicing, with travel, all of those things are basically middlemen or you know, realizing efficiencies in the middle. The challenge with that is very few of those innovations export. So and they also create very few jobs, relatively speaking. So as much as, you know, Facebook, for example, has changed a lot of people's lives and changed their habits and what they do day in and day out, it hasn't created that many jobs. They only have, you know, somewhere in the 4,000 range in terms of employees. And yes, it's created some small ecosystem of additional work, you know, for developers, consultants, people like that. But the challenge is when there's nothing that needs to be made, there's no supply chain, things don't have to be shipped, there's no drivers to be hired, and the ecosystem has a much smaller ripple effect than the ones we used to have with heavier, more capital-intensive industries.
So this is actually a fascinating topic for me because being from Israel, and we're a socialist country, right, you'll find a job or the country is going to support you. Whereas in America, it used to be very much production-based, right, with the industrial age and all that stuff. And then we moved into technology, and the gap increased, right, between those who know and those who don't know.
Yeah.
And, right? And so now you're saying this might actually move back into production?
Well, you know, the way I present it and when I speak at conferences is I show it as a fork in the road. You know, so if you were to take all of these white-collar jobs, these digital jobs that a lot of us have and are familiar with and people in our circles, you would think we're heading right towards, I describe it as either the Matrix or Wall-E. You know, so we're going to be, you know, completely digital, plugged into something, sharing thoughts directly into this Matrix-like network. Now, that would be the case if everything was in balance, if the economy, if we weren't in debt, if there weren't other countries on the planet that we needed to trade with. So if in a, you know, in a perfect world where only that white-collar sliver of digital people existed, that would be our trajectory. The challenge with that is that we are heavily in debt. The dollar has been depreciating. The global trade has been unfavorable for us for a very long time. So there will need to be a rebalancing. And I talk a lot about that in Econovation, what that will entail. Now, that rebalancing means that we're going to have to shift resources towards the physical world. And it may be the last gasp of you know, of the physical world, because you know all jobs you know in theory are going away. There have been a lot of articles about automation and how robots, even in China, are replacing workers there. So you know, if you think 100 years down the line, you know, you don't think someone is still going to be standing on an assembly line, or certainly not hundreds of thousands of people in Foxconn standing in assembly lines making iPads or whatever the current gadget of the day is. So that's going to be automated. Now, what we need to do in the meantime is affect this rebalancing, and quite frankly, it's going to happen at multiple levels. It's going to happen at an individual level. It's going to happen at a business level, and it has to happen in a government level, at a organizational level. And we've flubbed very badly the government component of it. You know, so one example is you know, the one way to use stimulus money effectively is to attract foreign manufacturers to the U.S. So that way you can have an engine that continues to provide jobs and provide products that, you know, even once the subsidy ends, you still have an engine that's roaring. We didn't do that. We spent all that money on one-time expenditures. We closed school budgets. We, you know, so budgets were cut, so then we supplemented them with a one-time or a two-time fee. Now, that's not building for the future. That's not providing infrastructure for, you know, for change. That's really just a sugar high. And so there are other things that can be done at a government level that can really drive innovation. But there are also things that individuals can do in terms of using tools and technologies that are available to us to affect this producerism, where we can be making things that can ship and export. So intellectual property, which has been our domain for the last you know, decade or maybe a few decades, is very hard to protect overseas. You know, it's very hard to protect movies. It's hard to protect software. It's hard to get China to buy our Google or pay for our Google ads when they can copy and make their own that they can control, which also creates domestic jobs and creates you know, a lever of control over their population. So strategically, we've invested very heavily in a lot of things that don't export very well.
So this is, well, fascinating to all my questions. So it sounds like we're kind of like in a rut, right? Because we are creating and developing more content, right, than physical things that we can sell, and then we have China that produces that we're going to China and asking them to produce that stuff, right? And China, in return, is actually protecting their own people, which leaves the U.S. with, okay, we'll send everything to China, it's cheaper, and we'll just create intellectual property.
Yeah, and you know, it really depends on the lens you look through, right? So, you know, you have this pure economic lens, let's say, that you could put on. So forget about countries for a second, and you just say, you know, how is economics playing out? Economics is doing exactly what it's supposed to right now. So it's basically taking the inefficient producer, which is us, and sending it to a more efficient producer or a relatively more efficient producer that can do it at a lower cost for whatever reason. Now, you know, in a pure scale, that means that the quality of life for those that are very poor is increasing, but the quality of life for those that who are very rich is decreasing. Now, you know, so if you view it as a pure economist with no partisanship, then economics is kind of doing its job. Yes, there are impurities, there are manipulations of currency, there are all of those things. But economics is working. Now, if you look at it from a country lens, and if you're looking at it strategically, just like China does, because they're a planned economy, they're looking at it as we need to get as many people out of poverty and as much a production out as possible and take as strong a position in the marketplace as we can before automation takes hold, and we're not going to be able to provide for those people. So that's why they've got a huge current account surplus, because they're preparing for the day when they're going to need to support a population that is that may not be able to support itself. Because remember, it's 1.2 or 1.3 billion people, and even now they provide huge subsidies to poor people just so they don't revolt or starve. Or, you know, one causes the other. So I think that we haven't been nearly that strategic. And I think the, you know, one step that we need to take is really have a much more powerful collaboration between academia, the private sector, and government. And we have to think strategically. What has been happening is been playing this one-off game where one state will go after the manufacturer and another state offer them a sweetheart deal, and essentially it's a zero-sum game. So it's a loser's battle because we all sink to the bottom that way, when we should be focused externally and saying, how do we package something, regardless of where it goes in the U.S., that's attractive to a French manufacturer, to a, you know, to a Chinese manufacturer, to a Korean manufacturer, to say, why ship all those products when you can make them domestically? And that manufacturing won't look like the manufacturing of old, but it'll still create jobs and it'll still create those ripple effects, you know, of supply chain that very low capital industries cannot.
So it sounds like China as a government taking care of their own people, but the U.S. as a government isn't. Right, and you're saying small businesses and individuals need to start figuring out how to capitalize on that trend?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of things that individuals can do, and there are a lot of things that businesses can do. So one of the things that I do, the way I make my living now, is I'm on retainer by a bunch of large companies who are trying to do, you know, X or Y in terms of, you know, mobile, in terms of online engagement, in terms of loyalty, in terms of new products and services. So what I do is I go in and I try to help them figure out what that thing should be, and then I find the right partners, whether it's a tech provider or a startup of some kind, that can help accelerate getting what they want into market faster. So in essence, what that's creating is a small to large partnership. So you might have a small provider that's doing something great, but they don't have the resources, the know-how, the brand name, or the distribution to get their product or their service out to other markets. But if you're dealing with a multinational corporation or a retailer with a supply chain around the world, then that small to large partnership suddenly opens up this huge gate this door for small companies to distribute to large groups of people. And that's a very powerful proposition. You're essentially using large companies as a platform for small companies. So, you know, I'm actually writing an article about this, so hopefully it'll come out. I have so many draft articles that I hate looking at my computer at this point. Every time I turn it on, I get depressed because everything is half written and it's driving me nuts. I just don't have the time to get to all of it.
You need to outsource to...
to China.
I was about to say China, but their English is probably not as great as yours.
No. I would be very critical of their writing.
So as a small, I think a lot of people are now using the internet as their jump board, right, toward financial success or any kind of financial income. And how do we deal with the gap? You know, those who grow up with iPads, those who grow up with laptops and internet connection, and those who don't have access to that, what do we do?
Well, you know, I've had a lot of direct experience with this. For about 15 years, I've been a volunteer for a Junior Achievement. Junior Achievement is where business professionals go into the classroom, into typically public schools, and they teach whether it's success skills, business skills, investing. I've done all of those different flavors. And I see firsthand the kids who don't have stuff. And there's a huge divide. I mean, the classrooms that you see in the suburbs look nothing like the classrooms you see here, where it's still chalk, it's still, you know, you don't see any gadgets, you see flip phones if you see any. So there is this huge, huge gap. Now, the good news is the technology is cheap enough now where with a relatively small investment, by the way, this would have been another good use of stimulus money, where we could have distributed not necessarily iPads, but some sort of tablet or device that eliminates the need for, you know, for books, that eliminates the need for notebooks, that eliminates the need for all of these other things that now poor kids have to buy to get an education. The good news is the information is free. It is out there. Now it's just being packaged in different ways by different companies. You see a lot of, you know, like Coursera and Udacity and Udemy. All of these different companies are trying to package education in different ways. So the education is out there. Codecademy is another one. There are tons of cheaper alternatives. Now, what is going to be the turning point is when employers stop buying into the college system. So that will be the real turning point. I think it's going to
start...
You
mean by degrees? You mean hiring...
But yeah, by degrees. So if we had other means of authentication, your ID is what you show to get on the plane. Your degree is what you show to get into the company. So when companies start to change that mentality and they start to think about competencies and qualifications instead of certifications, then we're going to have a very different job market. That is going to equalize and normalize the opportunities for people who are self-educated and also are willing to try and putting the effort in. So I think that the democratization and the tools of democratization are almost there. The knowledge is there, and it's free, most of it. What isn't there?
There's an issue, right? There's a mother who has four kids, right? And the husband is working as a maintenance guy, and they don't have the time to pursue that education, even though it's free, right? So the system is not set up so that the poor can jump, you know, to the base level where the rich are starting from.
Well, you know, but that goes to infrastructure investment. So I gave the iPad example before. I think freely available or heavily subsidized internet is the other part of the infrastructure component. So that's why I think public libraries are important, but not in the form that they exist today. I have another unfinished blog post I was writing about how Starbucks can replace the modern day library. And I actually make a financial business case for how that could actually happen. Now, you know, there's certainly a lot of nuances there, and there's a lot of complexities in terms of how you scale it, but it can be done. And I think that that access will be the turning point. So a few things have to happen. You know, part of it is a mentality change. Part of it is how we assess prospective workers. Another part is, you know, motivation. That has to be there because, the information from Wikipedia isn't going to dress itself up and jump into your head. Right. You still have to go and fetch it to some degree. So I think that, you know, a lot of it is motivation driven, and that's where my biggest fear is. My biggest fear is that the motivation is missing, the hunger is missing, that scrappiness is missing. That concerns me more. It's the human element of all this that concerns me more so than the economic or the the governmental or the corporate components of this.
So two questions before we open it up to our discussion. One, why do you think we are not motivated? And then the other one is, like, let's talk about the solutions. We have this issue. What can we do?
So the reason is pretty simple. It's the same reason innovation has slowed down. We've got a lot of stuff. And when you have stuff, you don't have motivation to go out and get more stuff or change your life. So you can subsist at a very comfortable level, and even though you're not excelling, you're not really living, but you're not really dying. You know, and so too many people are content with that, and there are cheap means of pacification that we have. You know, everything from Burger King to video games to all of these little gadgets that are reasonably affordable, even if you're poor or relatively poor. That pacifies you. That takes away some of the hunger. And we don't have a mechanism. And you know, and honestly, I don't really know that the government could ever provide. There's not enough social workers. There's not enough teachers. There's not enough anything in this country to compensate for a family that asks a kid, hey, did you do your homework? You know, so there's very little that institutions can do to replace the family unit, and that's one of the root causes, and that's where my greatest concern lies. Because, and that's something where, you know, there have been people who've talked about it, you know, especially minority communities. Bill Cosby was one who tried to speak up about it. He got shouted down by a lot of opportunists who, you know, really benefit from the suffering and the poor conditions, because they're, you know, that's how they make money. But the reality is that's something Obama should be talking about. That's something politicians should be addressing. But that's a hard problem, and no one wants to get involved. But that is a reality. The reality is that there are a lot of broken families that don't ask kids, did you do your homework? And there's no counselor in the world that will replace that.
That's so true. But you know what? It's interesting because, again, coming from Israel, Israel is tiny. You know, it takes you about an hour and a half from east to west. And so the family is always there. It's always like that family nest. And even if you move out of your parents' house, you're only like 30 minutes away. In the States, right, if you got a job in New York and you live in Austin, there goes the family. And because of the size of the country, it's very hard to manage, right, even with computer technology and all that stuff. So,
yeah. And, you know, the family unit is, you know, you look at the, I just wrote an article on LinkedIn today talking about, one of the things I mentioned in it was the immigrants that have come from Asia. They are now earning more than Caucasians in the U.S. because they're coming here with discipline, sometimes with tiger moms, and they are, you know, they're delivering, you know, in the sense that, you know, everyone here is talking about how the system is rigged, and meanwhile, you know, there are people who are coming here with no connections, no money, and somehow still ending up earning more than the existing population. So what is it? Is it it a rigged system, or is it something else? And I'm concerned that, you know, we've lost a little bit of what that something else is that needs to get us to that next level of changing our situation.
So you're betting on the family. You're saying if we get closer family ties.
I'm not betting on them yet. They're going to have to show me a little something before I'm putting. Yeah, no, I'm betting that part of the answer lies there. Yes, absolutely.
The family. So, what is the solution? What can we do? You know, to position ourselves as entrepreneurs and people who are concerned with the benefits of others, and you know, how can we contribute or change things?
Well, you know, I think, as you can imagine, a lot of it starts, when I say at home, not literally at home, but it starts with you, at the individual. And there are so many tools now that are available to us to educate ourselves. I mentioned a few of them earlier. There's so many tools available to even make a physical product. You know, everything from, 3D printers to, access to Alibaba. Now, granted, that's in China, but at least the mechanisms for accessing the means of production are now available to individuals. So I think that is very powerful. And the means of distribution are very democratized now. The means of fundraising through crowdsourcing and crowdfunding are democratized. And I think what the next evolution is going to be is not crowdfunding, but I'm calling it crowd making, which is the combination of things like Quirky, which actually makes the products for you. You submit ideas if you're the inventor. They pick the top ideas and they use their manufacturing expertise to actually help build it and distribute it. Now, that's one type of it, but I think there are going to be combinations that include things like Kickstarter that now allow the development of these, you know, combo tools that now shorten the distance between what's in your brain and the release of an actual product or service. And I think these partnerships with large corporations, you know, some that, you know, I'm certainly working on what I can do in that regard, but those are things that other people, other entrepreneurs need to be thinking about in terms of distribution. How do I distribute and who already has those means of distribution? So again, a lot more is within our control than ever has been in history.
So you're saying it's going to be easier to come up with an idea, find someone online who can produce it for you and distribute it for you. And
well, you not for you. No one's doing anything for you. Yes, there are
well,
some
you pay
like
them,
Quirky.
But you know.
Yeah, well, Quirky does it. They give you 30% of the profit. So, you know, they are, in essence, doing it for you. But it's not a guaranteed thing. There's no substitute for effort. There's no substitute for even failure. Those are things that people are still going to have to go through. But the means of accessing capital are getting much, much easier and much more democratized. And that's where, you know, pooling that capital, whether it's to elect better politicians or whether it's to select better products, all of those things are now being democratized and facilitated. And I like where that's going. That gives me cause to be optimistic.
So guys, let's open it up to discussion. If you have a comment, unmute. Yeah, hey, Holger.
Okay. I hope you can hear me.
I can.
I like to come back to the point, production outsourcing to China. It's a big challenge for companies on one hand. On the other hand, it's also really a big chance for innovation. I can see the trend in Germany. Because of this pressure, it causes a lot of pressure on companies. You experience this in the US also. And because of this pressure, companies have to become more innovative. And I can see this trend in Germany. And I think this is a good melting pot for a base, for more productive, for more employment, and for other stuff. How do you see this point, Steve?
You're absolutely right. You know, the challenge with giving up the means of production is that you are separating the so-called innovators from the thing that needs to be innovated. If you're not on the floor, seeing why something is, you know, transported at 2 p.m. in the middle of the workday instead of at, you know, 6 p.m. when everyone's done, or at 5 a.m. before anyone gets started. Or if you see inefficiencies, or if you see consistent, defects, or if you see other things, the innovation that is lost by having people on the ground is priceless. I mean, that is what we have lost. So yes, you might be able to get those headphones dirt cheap from China, but if they have defects, or if you want to improve them, you're no longer a witness to the process. So I think the importance of witnessing and taking part in the process is a huge input to any kind of innovation, and we have to re-engage in that production cycle. So Holger, I absolutely agree with you. I think it's stifling a lot of innovation because we're no longer part of that chain.
It's interesting, right? Did you ever read the Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance?
I haven't. No.
Not.
So but it sounds there, interesting.
Yeah, it's a philosophical, it's actually a true story about a guy who was obsessed with figuring out what quality is, and so obsessed he was a teacher, and he was so obsessed with it, it drove him crazy into the nut house. But what he was saying is that the problem with education is people come to the universities not to get an education, but to get that degree, right?
That's right.
And so the problem is that you are not going towards a profession because you love that profession, you go there because of mother, father, money, prestige, other things. But if you were a carpenter and you just loved making those chairs, then there's going to be quality in the chair that you make because of your love and your attention to details and all that stuff.
That's right.
Right? And so maybe what you're saying is that if we get personal with whatever it is that we're creating, the quality is going to be there, the joy is going to be there, and that's just going to be, I don't know, changing things
yeah.
to the better.
You know, I don't want to plug anything I've written, but this is particularly relevant. There's an article I wrote for Harvard Business Review. You can get it there, or you can go to my website, ideafactory.com, and you can I have all of it there. It's called Happiness Will Not Be Downloaded. In fact, I think if you just put it into Google, it'll come up. But what I talk about there are three things that drive happiness in the workplace. The first is tangibility. You want to see something produced. You want to see a change in the world. And a lot of our digital jobs don't do that. You know, the world looks exactly the same when you leave as it did when you came in. The second thing is physicality, touching or using the senses. We don't use any of our senses. We're in sensory deprivation for 8 or 9 hours a day, staring at a screen or typing on a keyboard. We're not smelling anything. We're not tasting anything. We're not touching anything, or nothing that interesting. So that is a big problem. That's not what our bodies were built for. So we have all of this body, and we're using this much of it. So that is a cause of a lot of dissatisfaction. And the third thing is helping others. That's another huge source of satisfaction. So I encourage everyone to read that article. I think it's one of the best things I've ever written. I'm very proud of it. But I also think that it gets at a lot of these truths where producing isn't so much about economics as much as it is about humanity in a lot of ways. Because we are disconnecting ourselves from our bodies. Hence my Matrix and Wall-E analogy. When, you know, why do you need this body when all you use is data? Why not just plug in and call it a life?
It's true. Let me, before Wolf, I don't know if you want to talk, but before we do that, there's a comment on the site. Someone said families were not around much in World War II, but people from that generation is called the greatest. They said their motivation came from their teachers and the schools.
Society was different then. It's hard to to pinpoint every variable. But keep in mind, immigration was considerably lower. Blacks weren't integrated into society. They weren't allowed to have certain jobs. They were barely allowed to even fight in the war. So society was very, very different back then. And I think that we need to deal with the reality we have today. And I just don't think that institutions at the scale the help is needed can provide that level. And people have to meet the institution halfway. I've been in classrooms where I've tried to throw out a kid who was disturbing everybody. Like for the first, so the class is 37 minutes long. I spent the first 8 to 10 minutes trying to shut this kid up. I told him, go stand outside. The teacher brought him back in and had him sit down. I said, what are you doing? She said, well, that's considered corporal punishment. You're not allowed to throw out the kid. I said, well, what's the name for keeping 34 other kids from getting an education? Does that have a name? I think it's called theft, right? Because you're robbing the rest of the class an education. So we need a little bit of common sense, and it seems to be missing. And quite frankly, I don't have a lot of confidence in a government that makes that type of rule, because it's predicated on political correctness, not pragmatism or what is best for society.
Gidon, you wanna jump in?
Yeah, I'll shut up if people have questions.
Steve, if I could mention something, I notice. Oops, someone else is talking.
No, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Wait.
I was going to mention, I see a big problem with the education industry, going to college. I have 6 kids in college right now, okay?
But wow. The thing is, you've been a busy man. Yeah, right? I'm going to need a drink after talking to you.
But the cost of college and how much they have to go before they even get the education that they went for. An example, in Eastern Europe, my wife is actually from Romania, where she's a professional opera singer, but she went to school to learn opera, and they learn it right away. When I went to college to learn for computer science, I spent 2 years before I even touched a computer in class. So with all this extra thing, they're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars, they get out of college, they're lucky to get a job at McDonald's probably, but they have to pay off all these loans.
Yeah.
I remember having a talk with all of them before they went in. Okay, I want to go to college. And I'd go, why? What do you want to do? What do you want to do? They don't know. They go to college because their sisters went and their friends went. It's a party thing. It's so much time partying and wasting money going in undeclared. And most of them come out of college and still don't know what they're going to do. So I think we have a problem with that, with the cost of it. And not only in education, but business as well. I mean, everybody wants such high wages. Look at all the people coming here from foreign countries getting all the minimum wage jobs. And we have such an unemployment problem. It's not because there's no jobs. We don't want to work for that amount of money. But those people, they'll come here, the foreigners will come here, and they'll work and save their money and go home and make more than, bring back more than what the doctors make in their own countries,
That's right. That's
so
right.
So I think it's so off kilter. No wonder we're outsourcing everything.
Yeah, and you touched on so many things. I'm afraid I'm going to miss a couple, but one theme that I cover a lot in the book, I have a whole chapter on education. In fact, the chapter is called Making Makers, and the one of the concepts I talk about is modularity in education, kind of on a need to have basis. Providing the education, modular upgrade. So instead of, reinstalling an entire operating system, why not upgrade just the one program? And there was a very practical example that I've personally lived through. I was a consultant at Anderson years ago, and Anderson had a school that they bought. They bought a university campus outside of Chicago, and whenever we needed to upgrade our skills, they would send the consultants there, and our peers would teach us the skills that we needed for the new workforce or the new service offering that we're going to provide or the new whatever, because that was, you know, their belief system. So the belief system of, you know, the founder, Arthur Andersen, was that you don't need an advanced degree. You need a peer-taught upgrades for when you need the skill that is necessary in the marketplace. And he lived and breathed that discipline. And I personally not only learned there, but I taught there. I taught strategy classes there. So I think modularity is going to be very important. And by the way, modularity is much more affordable than upgrading the entire operating system or installing a new operating system as you're doing onto your kids right now. You're installing the whole OS when all they need is maybe one, two, or three programs.
Yeah, exactly. Even when I speak to a lot of my students and what they want to do, you know, it's like you don't need to know everything. You know, you have a telephone. Who can you call that maybe knows some of that information, you know? If you don't have the information, as long as you can get it, it's fine. You know, it's like we have to learn everything ourselves.
That's right.
But then you're a master of all trades and jack of all trades, master of none.
That's right.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a huge problem, and I think there are solutions, but the employers, as I was talking about earlier, need to start buying into alternative certifications or alternative. Exactly. And the book.
I think we lost you there.
For a second. Gidon?
Yeah, so I have one question for you, Steve, which is, where are your glasses? I'm so confused.
You know, that is disorienting for people. I hate my glasses. I have it's so funny. There was one time where I was dating a girl who, I said, "How do I look with the glass?" She's like, "Oh, better." I said, "Well, how do I look with this hat?" She said, "Oh, better. How about the goatee? Better." So I'm like, so the more ways I can cover my face, the more attractive I become. There's something seriously wrong with that. So I've come to terms with the fact that I'm not getting any more beautiful, but I do try to wear contacts more often these days, just because it's easier, especially when it's cold in New York and you go between indoor and outdoor temperatures. Yeah, I don't get that fogging. Yeah.
Well, I still recognize you, but I have a more serious. I think I love what you're talking about with the education thing, and it's interesting. I don't know how to pronounce his name, but Peter Diamandis, I think is his name.
I know who you're talking about, but I don't know how to pronounce it any better.
Yeah, so I was just reading his book or listening to his book on abundance today, and one of the things he's kind of talking, it's kind of rings true with some of what you're talking about. And he was basically saying, like, God, we kind of have this whole leftover system of education where, you know, it was like math on the top and then, you know, kind of literature and then arts down on the bottom. He's like, you know, the math stuff, we live in a world where that could be flipped. I mean, so much of that stuff is now being automated by software and things like that and our ability to look things up. So I thought that was kind of an interesting way of thinking about this. And I love what you're talking about, kind of this whole idea of the education being not so much just limited to those days when we were in college, right, or, you know, before that, but it's now kind of creeping into other times in our life. I just thought that's interesting.
It is, and we as adults, or at least as thinking adults, certainly recognize when we don't know something, or when we get trepidatious about a certain business deal, like we don't know maybe the mechanics of an industry. We know that we need to upgrade our education, or seek out an expert, or contact an attorney. So we have that gut feeling. So we should be responding to that gut feeling, and we should have mechanisms that allow us to do that without having to, as you said, delve back into this retrograde, ridiculous system that now forces you into degrees and all these other things that, quite frankly, that are being taught by people who haven't been in the real world in ages. So they haven't had to upgrade themselves. So how do you expect them to upgrade your kids?
Yeah, it's a challenge for sure.
Yeah, Yeah, I don't know if I even answered your question because I tend to roll off. So I apologize.
I think you did. No, I think you did. Yeah.
There's something that in your book you wrote, Steve, about how do you upgrade your business and your kids with a little help from Mormons and kindergartens with hacksaw. What is that about?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. The Mormons are incredibly efficient at business. They're really good at it. And, you know, that's the kind of people say, oh, don't stereotype. Well, you know what? If that's your stereotype, you will take it every single time. The reason they're good at business, I've had firsthand experience with this. In fact, the former CFO of American Express was, a pretty senior Mormon in the community. And a lot of the hiring that we did was as a result of having him in that senior role was at BYU, at Brigham Young University, which is a Mormon school. So I personally worked with a lot of Mormons. And I have to tell you, they are sharp. And they're really, really good. And one of the reasons is they teach their kids from a really young age to sell, to present to others, to, you know, they have three-year-olds doing public speaking. You know, they go into the church and they have to present. So they develop this discipline and this level of accountability and doing chores and all these other things. And in fact, you know, by the time they hit, I think it's 17, it's either 16 or 17, they have to go on a mission. And you know, they drop their kids in the middle of some foreign land, and they have to come back with missionaries. My parents couldn't even drop me off 3 miles from my own house without worrying about me and having me call 7 times to make sure that I didn't get hit by a truck. They're dropping them off in Guatemala, and not only that, they're expecting them to come back with results. So that is a very different mentality, and it is ingrained from a very young age. And in fact, Israelis do, you know, something similar. I mention Israelis and Mormons in the same section of the book. And Israelis do it with military service. They instill a level of discipline that we don't have. I wish I had that military discipline. I'm too old and probably too fat now to benefit from it. But that discipline is incredibly powerful. It gets you to set your alarm every morning. It gets you, you know how much stuff you can get done before 8 a.m., before everyone else walks in? And military people have a tendency to do that. And non-military people, you know, we're artsy. We're creative. We roll in at 10:30. Well, you know what? The world has moved on by 10:30. So I respect that discipline, and it doesn't have to affect your creativity in the slightest. Discipline and creativity are not mutually exclusive.
It's very interesting, right? Because now there are like formulas for creativity.
There's formulas for everything. There's a lot of people who need to sell books. There's a lot of people who need to write articles. There's a lot of people who, you know, who are looking for paychecks, including me. So I think we're getting to a point where everything that needs to be said will have been said, and then what? We'll all stare at each other at our dumb blogs and go, okay, now what? Do we have to go back to work now? Hopefully, we get to that point sooner rather than later.
So there's actually something I would like to get you and Gidon in a conversation, because Gidon is very much about good business and how, you know, companies find their soul and, you know, do good in the world. And it sounds like that with your system, it's kind of like a little bit going in that direction, right?
You're asking me?
I am.
Okay. Well, you know, I guess I have a very philosophical view of business itself as a potential force of good. And I say potential for a reason. Gideon will probably correct me or fill in the gaps. I see the ability to create a business as being more charitable than charity. And here's why. Because you're creating something that's self-sustaining. You're creating something that potentially creates jobs. You're creating something that potentially creates a product that improves people's lives. So you are, and not only that, you're not relying on the kindness of strangers to provide it. You're providing something at a profit that can self-sustain and still offer value, and it'll and your employees can now go donate to whatever causes they would like to. Your employees can put their kids through school. They can pay for their mortgage. And if you grow and you provide this product and service to more and more people, you're actually creating a natural social good. Now, that can go horribly wrong in some cases, where companies don't behave in the right way, or they do have, a moral hole in their soul. I didn't mean for that to rhyme, but it did. So I think that's where, the social overlay happens. But I think ultimately, in my mind, and then I'm not speaking for anyone else or for Gideon certainly, but I think what's hard to do is to impair a business for the sake of social good, because other businesses won't necessarily be playing by those same rules. That's not to say that we need to pollute our rivers and destroy our environment to have a healthy competition, but I do believe that the rules need to be somewhat equalized. And what's happening now is U.S. companies are creating completely different and higher standards than the people we're competing with overseas. So we're saying pay for healthcare. We're saying have high, better emission standards. We're saying don't pollute any of the rivers. So we're saying all these things, and those are all the right things that we need to say, absolutely. But China or other places aren't saying half of those things. So now, we are at a disadvantage. So at some point there are trade-offs, and those are very hard things to make. And Gideon, I defer to you on this. I know you've done a lot more thinking on this subject.
I actually think you're right on. I mean, it's funny. I mean, except the last part I disagree with a little bit, and I'll come back to that. But I think I spent about 10 years at Microsoft, and before that working in China and stuff like that. And then I took 10 years off and worked in the nonprofit sector. Mm-hmm. And, I left that about 3 years ago, basically coming to the conclusion that really to change society, we need to change the economy, and that really the engine for doing that is business. Like, there's no the ability to scale impact. You really need that profit engine, because otherwise you're just relying on charitable contributions, and after a while, philanthropists get bored, right? They move on to the next thing or whatever. The thing I'm interested in is this question of how can you basically kind of change some of the DNA of the firm so that it's less focused on extracting profits and passing those on to external shareholders, and really more about keeping those within the firm and the mission of the firm and focusing it there. And I guess, I think the thing about making it difficult for the company to compete, I think that was maybe true probably 10 years ago, but I think we're moving into a world where everything is so interconnected. The firm and its customers and its suppliers and stuff like that, it's hard to run from bad behavior because it just gets discovered so easily today. And Apple, I mean, bringing things full circle, I mean, Apple's decisions now to start trying to move away from outsourcing and bring more of that manufacturing back to the United States are directly connected to the fact that they were relying on a supplier, Foxconn, in China, who was doing a bunch of stuff that customers here in the United States didn't want to be associated with, right? And so this brand started to get tarnished. So I think we live in a world where it's going to get easier and easier to bring kind of the good behavior of business together with competitiveness. That's my sense.
Well, I also think that we have the luxury in a rich society to think about those levels of accountability. The challenge in other third world markets, they're just grateful to get the product. They're grateful to be able to afford the thing itself. They don't have, you know, we're pretty high up Maslow's hierarchy, which is one of the reasons people don't want to take those crappy jobs that a lot of immigrants do. We think of ourselves here, and we're thinking about how do I, you know, become fulfilled from my job, whereas other people are like, how do I get a job? So that's a very, very different thought process and reality. So I think that we are lucky in a way that we can think about that, but others not so much.
Yeah, agreed.
So let me ask you both, because when you think about companies, right, when you run a company and it is for profit, most people, let me reverse. How many owners really care about the social impact and being charitable and doing good in the world as much as they do about running the business and making profit?
Gideon, I'll defer to you to answer.
Yifa, are you saying how many owners? Is that what you're saying?
Right, so how many business owners, right, care about doing good in the world more or just as much as they do about making a profit? Because to me it sounds like, yes, we all aspire to do that, but bottom line, I need my bottom line. And so if something good is going to interfere with my bottom line, I might say that I care about this, like Rashid was talking about not providing health care to your employees. Yeah, I want to do good in the world, but that affects my bottom line, so I'm not going to do that. I care more about the profit.
Yeah. So the way I think of it is kind of like shooting pool, right? You know, you have to hit the cue ball in order to hit the other ball that you're, you know, with the stripe or solid or whatever it is, right? The cue ball in this case is making a profit. Like, you don't do that, you can't hit this other goal, right? So no profit, you're out of business, and then no good comes out of anything. So what I'd say is that I think the question of ownership, I think that there's a huge difference. Dave, Phil, you were talking in one of the comments in the chat, you were talking about public companies. And I think that the question of ownership really splits between whether you're talking about public companies or companies that have basically taken in investment, external investors, versus, say, small business. And small business, you know, small businesses, entrepreneurs around the country, and that's the bulk of business. And those folks, you know, they own the whole business. You know, these are people that are, these are not huge businesses, but I would say they're probably not thinking about society so much as their community, right? Because their reputation is based in that community, and when they do things that screw over a customer here, or, you know, make it so this park looks like crap or whatever, I mean, that stuff comes back and it directly impacts them. But for public companies, there's just such a huge distance between the effects of what the company's doing and the ramifications to those individual investors, there's no accountability. So I think that's, you know, I would say that you need accountability of ownership, and that gets really diluted when things go public or when there's too big of a distance between those who own the firm and those who are actually managing it.
You know, there's one other element to social accountability that I think we haven't really discussed, and that's, you know, having some accountability to the country that you operate in. And I know now we're in a world of, you know, global corporations where, you know, sometimes they're, you know, for tax reasons, they're based in the Cayman Islands or some other place. But I think there is a certain level of obligation. You know, you have a lot of stakeholders. You have obviously your customers, but in a lot of cases, you know, for example, Walmart, your customers are also your employees. And, you know, that's where you start to get into this gray area where I don't know that there are a lot of great examples. So, you know, digital companies, it's easy because you have scale, right? You have a really educated, well-paid workforce, and
It's a long day, the sun is